Our next case is 13-579, In Re DM, a minor child. For the appellant, Mr. Magella.
Yes, Your Honor. Are you ready, Your Honor?
I'm ready.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. I, of course, am Gordon Magella for the appellant, DM. Your Honor, at this time, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, this case is about the juvenile court's discretion to order discovery prior to the one hearing that will determine whether a child is tried as a child or as an adult, and the consequences the prosecution faces when it refuses to comply with a discovery order. Your Honors, here, DM is a 16-year-old boy, and he was charged with an offense that would have mandated his transfer for criminal prosecution in the adult system upon a finding of probable cause. DM's trial counsel filed a request for discovery under Juvenile Rule 24, as well as a request for any Brady materials. The state did offer a partial response, did disclose the names of a few police officers, did disclose DM's and his co-defendant's statements. However, the state did not disclose two relevant police reports that defense counsel became aware of. Defense counsel filed a motion to compel discovery, asking specifically for these reports. The matters were argued before the juvenile court a number of times. The juvenile court decided that these reports should be discoverable and ordered the state point blank to turn over to defense counsel both of these reports, titled the 301 and 527B.
What was the nature of the reports? Why were they vital?
These were routine police reports. I believe one is titled the Arrest and Investigation Report. One is titled a Trial Preparation Report. They would have had information that were narrative statements from witnesses, as well as any statements, any observations of the officers themselves. Here there was a substantial break in time between the alleged offense and when DM was arrested. You know, there must have been a substantial police investigation. There should be substantial information in these reports. Of course, I have not seen them as they were never actually turned over to defense.
Counsel, are you suggesting that Juvenile Rule 24 should be identical to the Adult Criminal Rule 16?
I don't know that it needs to be identical, but I think looking at Juvenile Rule 24, witnesses' statements are clearly included within the ambit of that rule. I think these police reports are they could only really be of two sources. They can be statements that witnesses made to the police, fact witnesses, which are clearly discoverable, or statements that are about the officer's own investigation, which are also clearly discoverable. If there were, I know the state has made some arguments in its merit brief that, you know, perhaps these kind of reports could, you know, contain confidential information or investigative procedures, but the juvenile rules have a vehicle for addressing that. There is Juvenile Rule 24B, which allows for limiting of discovery. The state did not seek to limit discovery. The state simply refused to turn over these reports. There was no allegation that these reports contained, again, confidential information, anything about investigatory procedures, anything like
counsel,
that.
Counsel, what about, I know this is a juvenile matter, but what about the pronouncements from this court that when we get into these discovery violations, we would prefer that courts look at a less draconian measure, that isn't there a duty on all parties to cooperate?
Yes, and I would submit that here the state did not cooperate. There was a request for discovery, there was a motion to compel discovery, the state was able to make arguments about its position on discovery. The juvenile court specifically gave the state leave to file a brief on its position regarding discovery, and the state apparently failed to do so. So the state, I think, had every opportunity to vindicate its position in the juvenile court.
So your position would be that the only option open to the court at that point was to dismiss the action?
I think if we're looking at, I would imagine you're referencing State v. Darmond and the application of Lakewood versus Papadopoulos to state discovery violations, I think that's a very different situation than we have here.
Why?
Because in that case and a lot of the other discovery cases, there has been some kind of inadvertent failure to comply with discovery, something of that nature. I believe that's what happened in Darmond, that the prosecutor simply came in on the date of the hearing and basically said, I forgot to turn over this information. This is a very different situation. We have a state, not that the prosecutor mistakenly failed to turn over discovery or that there was some error. There was a direct and very clear order, both on the record and in a written order, the state turn over these specific reports.
Counsel, but I think what your friends on the other side might respond to with that is that they would say, well, we were prepared to file a writ of prohibition action, that they came into the hearing saying, that's what we're going to do. Is that the same as noncompliance to come in and say, we can't comply, but we are going to try to go get a court order and get this resolved? Is that your understanding of the record as well?
The prosecution did, on the date of the hearing, I think it was 11 days after they were ordered in a written order to turn over these reports, that on the date of that hearing, they were thinking about filing this writ of prohibition. I would say, and you know, obviously we're not talking about the merits of a writ of prohibition, but I believe the Burnside case that was decided by this court, not all that long ago, dealt with a very similar situation and found that writ of prohibition is not the correct remedy here. Obviously, we're not discussing the merits of writ of prohibition, but I don't think that was the correct vehicle. I will, however, say the state, as they always do, has the ability to request a discretionary appeal. Obviously, they had a substantial time period in which to seek a discretionary appeal. They certainly could have sought a stay. They could have done any number of things in that time period, in those 11 days between the court's discovery order and the scheduled pretrial hearing to...
Was there a request for an in-camera inspection?
There was not. And I think
wouldn't that have been the appropriate remedy for the judge to employ? That if you say that these 301s and 527s are discoverable and what you're looking for is Brady information, bring them to me and we will sit in chambers and I will look at them.
I think here we had we did not really get into the issue of Brady. We were talking, I think, more.
Wasn't that the rationale, though, that the defense proffered for the need for these police reports?
I think there was a request that they were or could potentially be Brady, that there could be some exculpatory information contained in them. But I think equally importantly, there was that request made just under Juvenile Rule 24. And I certainly appreciate that we've gotten to the point where we're talking about the scope of Juvenile Rule 24, because the First District did not. And I think that's really the threshold issue that really what brought this case to this court. The First District essentially said that bind-over cases exist in kind of a no-man's land where juvenile rules don't apply, criminal rule 16 doesn't apply, and I certainly submit that juvenile rule 24 does apply. We're still clearly in the jurisdiction of the juvenile court. So then the question is, are these statements, are these police reports ordinarily discoverable?
But in the Court of Appeals opinion, paragraph 16, they say, if the moving party can articulate a factual basis to support a good faith belief that the contested item may be privileged, and that's what was alleged here, the trial court must conduct an evidentiary hearing and or an in-camera review of the contested item before ruling. So whether it's a juvenile rule 24B or whether you're going to go with the application of rule 16, that's the procedure which governs how a judge deals with these things, correct?
Yes, but I believe the First District was speaking, and I certainly think that the law is fairly universal that they were really talking about the state's claim of work product privilege there. The state had claimed in the appellate court as well as before the juvenile court that these reports were privileged as a work product of officers. And I think the First District correctly said that, you know, unsupported assertions of counsel and things of that nature are not enough to go forward on a work product claim. If there is more substantiation, then it would be appropriate to have an in-camera inspection or some kind of hearing. Here, the state just sort of made that blanket argument. These are prepared by police officers, it's work product.
But as I understand the procedure in this case, a continuance was granted to the state to figure out how they were going to defend, correct?
Yes.
And then the court continued it to the 19th, and you filed a motion to dismiss on the 16th. So where's the hearing?
Well, that hearing, the state was given an opportunity to further brief the matter. My recollection of the record is that really is what happened. The state had set that next date as the 19th to be the probable cause hearing. So the state, again, had their opportunity to file any briefing they wanted. They had, and again, coming out of the 8th, November 8th, we already had the juvenile court's order that, based on counsel's representations during the hearing, that these were, in fact, discoverable. We had a very clear order that they be turned over.
Do you customarily encounter this at bindover hearings?
This kind of opposition to discovery?
Yes.
Should the
discovery be limited to the nature of the bindover hearing, as to age of the juvenile, nature of the offense, or should it be expanded in your view?
My view would be that this court and the Supreme Court of the United States have found that a bindover hearing is critically important, I think, and they found that due process and fair treatment.
I'm trying to get you to talk reference the evidence that ought to be presented at such a hearing.
I think, yes. The simple answer is yes, that we are still in the juvenile court. The juvenile rule should apply to that proceeding. Juvenile Rule 24 should apply to that proceeding. Therefore, I think we should go into it with that Rule 24 applies.
And these are customarily not delivered at bindover hearings. That's your experience.
It has not. Honestly, from my practice in the court, a number of these reports the state will refuse in a number of recent cases to provide.
Do you have any case authority that says they should be or have been delivered from other jurisdictions at the bindover hearing?
This situation, I don't believe, has arisen exactly.
So we're talking first impression as to whether a police report ought to be discoverable at a bindover hearing in a juvenile court. Is that right?
To a certain degree.
But research shows?
To a certain degree. But I think we're also talking about the discretion of trial courts to order discovery.
Is that a constitutional claim that you're making?
I think there is a due process issue that is a constitutional claim. But I think there is also a rules claim under Juvenile Rule 24, which, I mean, frankly, is where I really think that this probably should be.
So you're focused on the rule rather than the constitutional claim?
I think the rule would be the simplest way for this court to decide the issue.
Well, and if we're persuaded that more is better, perhaps it's a rule change rather than a decision in this case that needs to occur.
I don't think it's a rule change. I think, again, we have that threshold issue. Does Juvenile Rule 24 apply? I think it does. And then there's that issue that I think the state has argued more in their merit brief of what is the scope of Rule 24. And I believe these reports, again, what is a police report? It's information that either fact witnesses have relayed to the officer or information the officers have preserved themselves.
You're not maintaining the juvenile's entitled to more than an adult defendant, are you?
No, absolutely right. Not. And I think that's part of this too. Sort of the subtext is, I think very clearly the state even concedes these would have been discoverable under Criminal Rule 16.
The theory behind your argument is it's a matter of fairness. If this juvenile is about to be treated as an adult, then let's serve up the information right at the front end of the case.
Exactly. Really, what I would submit under Rule 24, the report's discoverable. Under Rule 16, it's discoverable. You know, why delay discovery? Why have these due process impacts on a child? Why not just have the open discovery?
And Counsel, this was at the point where it was the bindover hearing, correct?
Yes.
But you note that had this individual been bound over, these reports would have been discoverable in the adult court.
I believe they would have been, and the state, I believe, has conceded such, yes.
And the 6th and 8th district that you cite, you cited cases from those two districts,
yes,
as being different from the 1st district.
Yes.
Were those cases also related to bindover proceedings or not?
Yes, they were.
And they said what?
They said, the 8th district said that a juvenile is entitled to, at a minimum, discovery that is, I believe they used the term coextensive with the issues to be decided at the bindover hearing. The 6th district said, at a minimum, what's relevant for the bindover hearing. And I think the 8th district dealt with this probably properly, that they applied the juvenile rules, and they said, if there's a limiting to be done, there is that juvenile rule mechanism, Rule 24B, to limit discovery. So if the state had some reason to try not to disclose information, they can seek a limiting instruction. Under that rule, that's the remedy.
Well, isn't that
if we agree with you, do we have to get to the issue of the remedy that the trial judge had here, which was to dismiss the case? Do we have to get into that? The Court of Appeals did not address it because it said it was moot based on its ruling.
Yes. I suppose you don't have to. I do think that you should, because I think that this is certainly something that is more than capable of repetition. And I think we have a different situation here than what we had in Darmond. We have a state that's actually refused to turn over discovery. We're coming into a hearing after they'd been ordered to provide it, and they simply did not. It's a very different situation.
But that's the problem that I'm having here, is that you really haven't answered the Chief's question of, wouldn't this have all been resolved if there was a hearing, so that if we could determine whether it was these reports or all reports?
Well, I think there was a hearing, and the court did determine that these reports were to be discovered.
Based on what?
Based on the arguments that the state presented. And based on Rule 24, and certainly you've all read.
But no one on this panel knows what's on those reports.
Neither do I. I think that's.
That's the problem, is it not?
I think that is the problem. But I think it's something that, based on information and representations made to the juvenile court, in its discretion, ordered that those reports be turned over. The state did not seek an in-camera inspection. The state did not request a limiting instruction. They simply said, we don't have to provide these documents. The court disagreed and ordered that they be provided. And the state
Although,
didn't.
Counsel, wasn't the state given until December 19th? Mm-hmm. And then, or I'm sorry, November 19th, the matter was continued. And then on November 16th, the court dealt with the motion to show cause and the motion to dismiss. So that was 3 days before the state was given its time, right? Isn't that a problem?
And perhaps I am a bit foggy on the record. My understanding was that it was continued to the 19th
for the probable cause hearing,
yes.
Right? And then on November 16th, upon a motion to show cause, the court dismissed the case.
Well, I believe the court dismissed the case on the 19th. The motion to show cause was filed on the 16th.
It says on November 16th, as of today's date, the state has not complied. The court dismisses.
Again, my apologies, Your Honor. Perhaps I'm a bit off on the dates. I mean, my understanding was that this happened on the 19th.
Okay, we'll check with the other side. Thank you. Right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cummings.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices of the Supreme Court, Phil Cummings for the state of Ohio and Hamilton County.
Mr. Cummings, could you
yes,
clarify that, the dismissal, when it actually occurred, and if the state had been given more time, and yet the case was dismissed before the state had the chance to respond.
Yes, that's true, Your Honor. It was abruptly dismissed on the 16th, I believe. The state was in the process of preparing a record and preparing a writ. And as you mentioned, Justice O'Neill, yes, if there had been a hearing, we could have made a record and we could have explained our position here. And that's what I hope to do briefly here this morning. I understand that this court is not an errors court, but I do know that this court could use this case to address two major issues that would be a benefit to all the courts of Ohio. The first one would be to define what due process requires be turned over in discovery to juveniles in bindover hearings. This is an issue that's going to recur. Secondly, the state in this particular case is extremely interested in the second prong, and that is asking this court to reaffirm the existence of and the protection afforded to the work product of counsel.
Counsel, don't we have a couple more threshold issues before we get to those issues? Do you? I'm having trouble seeing where the two sides disagree at this point. Do you agree that Juvenile Rule 24 would apply to this proceeding?
Yes.
Okay, so we agree, which is different from what the First District said, correct?
The First District said that ultimately whether Criminal Rule 16 or Criminal Rule 24 applies will be determined based upon the outcome of the bindover hearing. And the First District was actually struggling with the issue that other districts in this state have tried to grapple with, which is exactly what is the extent that due process requires discovery to entail at a bindover hearing.
So if we were to say both sides seem to agree that Juvenile Rule 24 does apply to bindover hearings, do we need to decide anything else, or do we just hold that and we send it back to the First District for further proceedings?
Well, I think it's important that you say more than Juvenile Rule 24 applies, because Juvenile Rule 24 can be interpreted in a couple of different ways, and I think it's important for this court to make clear what its interpretation of Juvenile Rule 24 is. For instance, it's the state's position that the First District got it right, as did the Sixth District and the Eighth District. To this extent, all the courts are agreeing that a juvenile is entitled to some discovery at a bindover hearing. Everybody agrees that a juvenile is entitled to Brady material. That is being provided to juveniles throughout the state and in Hamilton County as well. I think the issue that's going to recur, unless this court weighs in on it, is a juvenile entitled to unfettered open file discovery at bindover hearings? And believe me, that's what's being argued in the courts. We need.
But they're entitled to that if they're bound over, correct?
Of course, they're entitled to discovery. You know,
open
coextensive
file discovery, Rule 16 discovery, right?
Criminal Rule 16 discovery, but not open file discovery. The state would note, and this is the key point that caused the pushback in this case, both Juvenile Rule 24A3 and Criminal Rule 16J1, both sets of rules acknowledge and provide for a work product exception to discovery. It's the state's position that we are not going to be turning over the 527B in juvenile court or in criminal court.
Describe what a 527B is.
Gladly. That was what we were hoping to do at a hearing that we didn't get to before this case was dismissed. In Hamilton County, in 1994, we went to the Rapid Indictment Program. As a result of that, instead of a four-page trial prep report that the prosecutors often would work with officers to produce, they went to what was called a 527 format. The 527A is an arrest and investigation report. That's a public record. That is generally provided to defendants in all discovery in both court systems. The 527A also contains a bond information sheet, and it lists the witnesses that are requested to attend court. This 527A is also provided to defense counsel in both the juvenile system and under Criminal Rule 16 in the adult system. However, in 1994, we also asked the police to produce what's called a 527B form. That is a trial preparation report form that the state specifically requested police officers to produce for us in anticipation of presenting the case, in anticipation of litigation. It says right on the form, it's a trial prep work product form.
And I was wondering about that when it was mentioned earlier. So that you maintain both in the juvenile and adult system is privileged matter that is not discoverable under Rule 16.
Correct. It's not discoverable under Rule 16.
So it's the same difference either court.
Either court.
So the term here, police report, is what's confusing. Your 527B is not the same as an officer who apprehends a traffic offender and brings that person to juvenile court with a motor vehicle report, which we would call a police report.
Correct.
Would you say that document would be admissible at a bindover hearing in a juvenile proceeding?
The police report is. The 527 and the 527A, yes, those are discoverable.
So give us an example.
But your document that you also call a police report is a work product document prepared by police officers for the prosecutor, and that's what's at issue in this case.
Correct. That is produced.
Excuse me for interrupting.
No, that's fine. And what describe for us what typically would be in that confidential report? What does that look like?
Typically,
what are they telling the prosecutor? Kinds of things, not referring to this case, but as an example.
As an example, typically it contains essentially the very same information that's on the 527 and the 527A. However, in some cases it contains additional work product information, such as a police officer's theory on a case, a list of confidential informants, an explanation of police techniques. When it contains this type of material,
it contain a heads up on this person has hired Joe Smith as his defense counsel, and you should be aware that these are five of Joe's favorite ploys in court.
Absolutely.
Because you've got a prosecutor who may have just gotten out of law school or just been hired, and the cop's been dealing with this lawyer for the last 10 years. That kind of thing would be in there?
Exactly. And that's why the state was caught off guard when the trial court below was all of a sudden ordering these 527Bs to be turned over.
Are the contents, in addition to officers' insights, do they contain anything else?
Yes. They often contain summaries of witness statements. They contain
but
sometimes exculpatory.
But those witness statements are available through the regular discovery process, so that's duplicative.
Correct. And that's what I want to make clear. The prosecutor understands its obligation to turn over witness statements, witness summaries of statements, favorable information, and to the extent that any of that is ever contained in a 527B, it's being turned over. We understand that we have
enough. So if there was any Brady information in the 527B, it would be duplicative of what would have been discoverable under the 527A or 527s.
Yes, and that's what I want to make clear. We are already providing Brady material, evidence favorable, witness statements, summaries of witness statements. We just want to be able to protect the unique work product that sometimes is on these five.
Now, if defense counsel thinks, well, yeah, you say that, but you're not coming clean on the Brady material or whatever, the process to determine that would be an in-camera inspection by the judge, right?
Or as the First District contemplated, some type of a hearing where this could be fleshed out, yes. But I think it's important to realize that what the appellants are seeking here is really open file, unfettered discovery. I mean, this is page 22 of the amicus brief. Defense counsel must always seek to examine all police documentation and records in a case. Prosecutors should adopt open file discovery policies. That's what the appellants are seeking this court to validate here, and it's the state's position that due process simply does not require that.
Are you suggesting that there's a limitation on discovery at a bindover hearing different from a proceeding in the juvenile court on the merits for an adjudication of delinquency, for example?
Yes. I think the limits at a bindover hearing are informed by the limitation of the scope of the hearing itself. If you look at Juvenile Rule 24A6, it speaks about, in all of these issues, it says the evidence should be provided that's relevant to the subject matter involved in the hearing. It's the state's position that when you have a bindover hearing, the issues are very limited in scope.
Is a police report not a 527B, but is a police report discoverable at a bindover hearing, in your view?
Yes, the 527 and the 527A, and we are providing those.
At a bindover hearing?
Yes.
And that process then is consistent, if I understand the argument, with both the decisions of the 6th Appellate District.
Yes.
And the 8th Appellate District in Cahoga County.
Yes.
So to that extent, there's no conflict among the appellate districts.
Not at all.
The only distinguishing factor in this case is the work product police document that you're seeking to protect.
Correct. And that's why we pushed back on this issue, and that's why the trial court below.
Does that include the 301s? What's a 301 police report then?
The 301 is a similar report as to the 527B that the Cincinnati Police Department uses. And they adopted that form as a counterpart to the 527B.
The problem I have with this case, because we're trying to come up with a policy for all the juvenile courts, and it seems to me that the Court of Appeals here has just summarily decided they abused their discretion when they told them to turn over the 527B and the 301 police reports. How did the Court of Appeals reach that conclusion?
Because it determined that those reports were not discoverable at a bindover hearing, because the issues at a bindover hearing are limited in scope, and the First District agreed with the 6th and 8th districts and said that in a bindover hearing, discovery can be properly limited to the issues at issue at the bindover hearing. And in that case, that includes material favorable to the juvenile and any other discoverable material, like witness statements and summaries and so forth.
Mr. Cummings, if we'd agree with your view, do we need to write something, or do we simply affirm what the First District has done, or do we clarify something that the First District has done?
Please clarify. Please clarify. We're asking this court to make very clear and state in the Ohio Supreme Court's opinion that this court finds due process requires this to be produced in discovery for a juvenile at a bindover hearing.
Well, would that be a rule clarification of Juvenile Rule 24, or is that something we document in our opinion, or is it a combination in your view?
Well, I think it's a clarification and interpretation of Rule 24, and I think that that's what the other districts have tried to do.
You want us to say, articulate what we believe due process requires at a minimum.
Absolutely. I think it's critical that this case provides this court an opportunity to tell all juvenile courts what due process in Ohio requires a juvenile be entitled to at discovery at a bindover hearing, mandatory or discretionary. I think it's key that we come away with that in this decision.
And you're saying it's really protection of attorney work product that you're concerned about here?
Yes, and that's what precipitated Hamilton County's pushback in this particular case. We thought that the court was way over expansively reading what discovery requires at a bindover hearing, and in that broad sweep, it was ordering us to turn over work product doctrine, which we've never turned over the 527B.
So is it a matter of saying protection of work product, or is it a matter of saying you are entitled to Brady material at a bindover hearing? Which is it? Which is more important as an emphasis to you?
They're both equally important. I think it's critical that this court state what due process requires be turned over, and I would submit that the First District got it right. A juvenile is entitled to all evidence favorable known to the state, and every evidence it's going to use at the bindover hearing.
If I understand your argument, if there's Brady material in the B, what's the number?
527B.
Then the rest of that report would have to be redacted, and the Brady material would have to be disclosed.
Yes. We are already
said the Brady material is ascertainable in another format, not the 527B.
Absolutely. We are under an ethical obligation under Brady to turn over the evidence favorable to the defendant under Brady, under this court's ruling in Iacona. We have to turn that over. We know that. If it's to the extent it's contained in the 527B, they're already getting that. All we're saying is there are going to be some cases where there's going to be sensitive work product material in a 527B.
You don't want a 527B to be turned over any time.
No, it's our position that is...
Or the police department's 301s.
Correct.
And your position here is, yes, bindover should get the Brady and any witness statements that are relevant to the issues to be decided
at
bindover, but under no circumstances are work products, such as the contents of a 301 or a 527B, discoverable at the bindover hearing, nor subsequent to bindover.
Absolutely.
And you're,
so how do,
go ahead.
How would we answer that question in this case in terms of what is work product? What's privileged here? The First District didn't address that question. We don't have the documents. How do we address that here?
Well, I think you could embrace the First District's reasoning and say that in a case where the state feels that there is some work product or privileged material, the state can bring that to the attention of the trial court and have a hearing. That could have happened in this case had it not been abruptly dismissed before we got to that point.
And your view is our articulation of what the minimum due process requires would square with the rule, no need to touch up the rule at all?
No, I think you could do justice to due process and the rule simply by saying that a juvenile is entitled to all evidence relevant to the issues that are at issue at a bindover hearing, just like it says in Rule 24, which includes Brady material and all evidence that we intend to use to establish the elements of the crime. And you can also give effect Juvenile Rule 24A3, which protects work product. And that's all we're asking, is that this court also reaffirm the existence of and the protections afforded to work product.
Do you see the danger if we just say all 527Bs are privileged? That's a problem.
Excuse me, whoever has that phone, will you please leave the room?
Your Honor, if you could say 527Bs are not discoverable, that would be great for Hamilton County.
I know
County,
you'd like that.
That wouldn't have statewide application because I know not all law enforcement jurisdictions have a 527B form per se.
I presume what you really want is a holding from this court that when you are claiming privilege, there shall be a hearing.
That would have been all that we would have wanted at this hearing below, and this would have solved the problem. And we would have done justice to due process and the criminal rules in their language. I think it's important just to end on this note. The appellants and the amicus characterize juveniles in Hamilton County trapped in a system like they're Wally Cox underdog type individuals that don't stand a chance. They're denied due process. They're denied discovery. That just couldn't be farther from the truth. As the First District said in this case, DM received discovery. He received evidence favorable. He received all the evidence that we were going to use at the bindover hearing. And as all the districts that have looked at this have said, that's all due process requires at a bindover hearing. And that is informed by the language of Rule 24, which says this rule should be interpreted to apply to the subject matter involved in a pending action. And at a bindover hearing, the issues in a pending action are that minimum probable cause to move forward. Yes.
And just one question regarding Criminal Rule 16. Knowing that we have basically redone that rule, or it has been redone in the recent past, nothing currently says anything about attorney work product, does it? I mean, it's a proactive rule saying here's what needs to be disclosed. This would not have any negative impact on the rules for adults, would it? In your view?
No, I think you'd be echoing Criminal Rule 16J1. It says information not subject to disclosure. The following items are not subject to disclosure under the rule: materials subject to the work product protection. Both 16 and 24 acknowledge the existence and the efficacy of work product. That's all the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office is asking for an acknowledgement of in this case, and we would have proven the validity of that had we had a hearing below.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Margiello, you've used all your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, just to answer Justice Lanziger's question, it was dismissed on the 19th of November. There is one other point that I do want to make, though, that we've talked about what's the remedy when the court asserts work product here. And I would say first, I think this is a fairly flimsy work product assertion. Because, you know, listening to Mr. Cummins, you hear about 20 years ago the prosecutor's office instructed the police department to start using a different form. These are still reports prepared in the ordinary course of police work. I don't think there is any evidence put forth here that there is any involvement of counsel, anything that would make this the work product of counsel. Work product of police officers is not subject to work product protections. And I do think there's a remedy that a number of you have mentioned, the idea.
So you're saying all the thoughts and all the recording of I drove out to Maple Avenue today and I looked for this or that. They're all in the form that would be deemed confidential. They don't have a separate blotter or report, the running report of their activities as they're investigating a particular crime.
My understanding from the representations Mr. Cummings and others have made is that this really is the narrative of the investigation. I have seen a blank copy of this form, and it has, you know, witness information up at the top, and it has a narrative
well,
space.
Well, aren't you getting other stuff out of the file, though, when you make your requests?
I mean, it's not like we've gotten no discovery, but there could be additional and different information in this report, and that's important for impeachment.
Well, I think there's admitted that it's officer insight that is relevant to how the strategy, impressions of the officer, and it's a communication between the officer and the attorney for the state.
But it's not an officer working as the agent of counsel. I think that's a difference for work product considerations. It's still a report prepared by an officer in the normal course of his police work.
No, it's prepared for the anticipation to be utilized. I mean, that's my impression from the prosecutor's office, that this is prepared for the purposes and the use of the attorney that is associated with the case.
I respectfully, Your Honor, my understanding is that these are, again, sort of prepared in the course of work. And again, I don't know because I
so
I
on the
not
flip side, if a private investigator works for a defense counsel and prepares a trial report so that defense counsel would be able to examine witnesses as a result of that investigation, you'd say that's a discoverable report. And your private investigator that you paid privately to prepare the defense would be discoverable in the normal course of a Rule 16 discovery. Is that right?
I think the germane issue is the issue of agency.
Can you say yes or no to that question, sir?
I do not believe it would be discoverable, no.
It would not be. Thank
no.
you.
Thank you.
Well,
thank
counsel,
you,
where's your client now?
I believe he is on electronic monitoring on some unrelated offense. So he's
an adult at this point?
Yes, he is an adult at this point. So this is all, and I think that's part of the prologue to this. This has all been substantially delayed because the state simply refused to turn over reports that they could have 2 years ago, and they didn't.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshal, will you call a recess, please?